now it's time for me to hand it off to our leading francophile and highlight of the conference, Monsieur Emelt, vous avez la parole. You have the floor.
Great, Steve. Stephen, might I add, that was an awfully bold decision you made. Stay a year, really, really, you know, you teach us all. So good morning, or as we like to say at GE, bonjour. It's good to be with you. And just at the highlight, look, 14's looking good, on track, no change to the model. We feel good about where we're positioned. We're executing the strategy. To do the retail finance spin, executing on our key initiatives. But what I really want to spike out today is some ways the company's different, some big advantages we think we're building in areas like analytics and globalization and some portfolio moves, and really give you a sense of some of the big changes that are going on inside the company right now. So the environment's, you know, I'd say generally getting better. U.S. gets a little bit better. Every day we see demand for credit. You probably heard it this week, Europe growing again, you know. Emerging markets, we're still quite positive and bullish on the emerging markets. Good value gap, so inflation is benign, and lots of volatility around governments around the world, and our big themes continue to be intact. So we're, you know, I would say, more bullish on the environment and feel pretty good about the way GE is positioned in that regard. The segments, really no update on the segments. Off to a good start in the first quarter this year. Power a little stronger, healthcare a little weaker, but really across the board, I'd say pretty consistent with the expectations we set out at the beginning of the year. The team's executing well, and we're seeing some good acceleration in some key segments, and so we like kind of the profile and of the segments and how we're doing, and we think some of the businesses that got off to a tough start, like energy management, are going to rebound in the second quarter and ought to be still meet the objectives for the year. No change to the way we think about corporate. I just wanted to highlight a couple things. Corporate costs are going to be down $500 million, so we're, you know, simplification is driving across the entire platform. And we still plan to do more restructuring than we have gains. So we're doing a ton of restructuring this year, somewhere between $1 billion and $1.5 billion, and that'll help us this year, next year, and into the future. And that's why corporate remains a drag. So the earnings of the company would be even higher, and the earnings growth rate would be higher if not for the uncovered restructuring, which we think is going to position us going forward. No real change in cash expectations for the year. Our revenue expectations for the year. We started off industrial organic growth at 8%, so we feel good about the profile of the company and in terms of where it goes. We're executing the strategy. You know, we expect to do the retail finance spin in the third quarter, or the IPO in the third quarter. So we're on track for that, and I think we've got more certainty around the timing. We feel good about the third quarter for execution of the IPO. Industrial earnings growth, double-digit earnings growth driven by organic growth in the 4-7 range, and we continue to see good margin enhancement across our businesses. GE Capital's on track to earn $7 billion this year. We expect to get a $3 billion dividend from GE Capital this year, but that's the precursor to getting a ton of cash out of GE Capital next year when we do the retail finance spend. So no change in really expectations along those lines, and good steady earnings growth while we're going through the portfolio transformation. So we expect to continue to grow the dividend in line with earnings. We expect the share as we do the RFS split to get the shares down to 9 to 9.5. We still expect to do at least $4 billion of dispositions this year, $4 billion of cash. The balance sheet is extremely strong in financial services, and we're on track to hit the return on invested capital of 17% by 2016, as we talked about in December. So we're executing the strategy and very focused on the things we're doing there. You know, we still expect to get a gain in retail finance. It's unclear whether that's going to be in continuing operations or discontinued operations. It could very well be in disc ops by the time we get there. So that's kind of the lay of the land on strategy execution. And the profile of the businesses, look, we really feel like the industrial businesses are gaining momentum, a good backlog. Our initiatives are pretty powerful in terms of sustaining the kind of organic growth we're getting this year. We see good margin enhancement this year that's sustainable and leading into the future. And we're looking at the portfolio and either getting margin enhancement of some of the underachievers or find ways to create value along those lines. In GE Capital, you know, I'd say we now are thinking about by 2015, once we do the retail finance spin, a number more like $300 billion in E&I versus $350. So we're going to execute the spin. We're still looking hard at the red assets and see a lot of non-core opportunity. We're seeing good growth in the core GE Capital assets and looking for ways to making GE Capital even more capital efficient as time goes on. So this is the way to profile the company going forward. We think the execution is improving and the strategy is really, really on track. So if you shift now, what I'd like to do the rest of the time is just kind of talk about, you know, the future. So you heard, I think the last time we spoke with you about the Alstom transaction. The Alstom transaction would add 8 to 10 cents incremental EPS in 2016. We would expect it to close in 2015. We've got a great foundation in 170 countries with more than $200 billion of backlog, good team, well deployed, lots of cash. You've got a great foundation. And really, on that foundation, I think there's just a couple thoughts I would give you that I'll talk a little bit more about today. One, in technology, we've always had a great technical company. We've got a fantastic profile of new products. And we're adding to that the capability of executing these products more quickly and at lower cost. So big initiatives are going to make that better. Probably an unmatched framework in emerging markets. And I think I want to give you more of a sense of how much of a competitive advantage we have as we approach these emerging markets. I know this week you've talked a little bit about the industrial internet. We've been doing it now for 4 years. So we have, I think, a head start in terms of how we view analytics and the power that's going to bring in terms of growth and margins for the company going forward. With simplification, we've kind of expanded that, and it really is changing the culture of the company, the way we run the company, to make us faster and lower costs and more competitive, and we're tremendously excited about where that leads. And we're going to execute on those initiatives no matter what. And then I think the way I look at Alstom is Alstom allows us to accelerate our portfolio goals, allows us to get to 75-25 from an industrial financial service standpoint. It's a pure play infrastructure play for us, and it just makes things better, faster as we look forward. So these are the ways that I'd like you to think about the company really getting better as we look at the future. So technology is a key advantage for the company. We invest about 5% of our revenue back into R&D. We're a big patent filer, top 10 patent filer, both globally and inside the United States. And this allows us to gain market share. It allows us to drive good manufacturing costs and grow margins. And allows us to fill product line gaps like diesel, power generation capability, other product gaps that we have in the company. So technology is always what sets up the installed base. It's a key part of our strategy. And we think we're really well positioned. Every year, you know, I talk about the breadth and depth of the company and the technology that we're advancing. The Tier 4 locomotive, we think, is 2 years ahead of competition, is going to be very well positioned for 15 and 16 and build a big advantage. The Revolution CT is FDA approved and now out there and positioning us to grow market share in 15 and beyond. We made good progress in the water business, and we're now positioned in a ton of the unconventional fuel areas as ways to grow. And we built a high market share, high margin bioprocess manufacturing business that's well above $1 billion with very high margins, and we think these are other things we can do both organically and inorganically inside the company. So we just continue to launch broad and deep technologies inside GE. We also bring it to new industries. And, you know, one of the ways that we drive synergies with the oil and gas growth that we've seen is by using the totality of the company in oil and gas. And we're able to do this in ways that's highly believable to our customers and far ahead of what our competition can do. So not only do we have all the technologies that we bring into oil and gas, but we can bring healthcare technology into the imaging of pipes and doing inspection, which is number one to big customers like Exxon and BP. We can bring power conversion to the electrification at the subsea factory. And there's other technologies we can bring to build systems for our customers. We're adding to this by having a global research center in Rio and one in Oklahoma City. So we are really surrounding the industry in a very powerful way that's recognized by our customers. And we're doing technology in a different way. I think with FastWorks, we're into our second year of really driving this around the company. The H-Turbine is a good example of a product we brought to market much faster and much lower cost. So big improvements in cycle time, big improvements in program expense. We're going to be shipping units in 16. We're bidding on a tremendous array of new opportunities. Our market share is going to be high in this product. And this was just done a different way. It's leveraged some of the early H technology we had. We now have hardware engineers that through using modern tools are able to operate more like software engineers in terms of their ability to pivot. And we've got total focus on what customers are expecting. So 61% efficiency, more than 400 megawatts of output. This is going to be the most efficient, biggest unit and out there in record speed by 2016. And from a cost standpoint, all of these engines that we're launching are going to be shipped at lower cost points in the future than how we originally looked at them. And this is going to be because of the work we've done on should cost analysis, advanced manufacturing, better welding techniques, better additive manufacturing techniques, doing a lot in terms of sensors inside our factories. And so our manufacturing teams are aligned with our engineering teams to do things better and faster in the future than they've ever done before. And we think this, in addition to all of the efforts we've had in R&D, is just going to make GE that much further ahead than the competition looking forward. We are a really good global company with a very diversified footprint in the growth markets. I think the work that John Rice has done over the last 3 or 4 years has really given us a diversified portfolio. And as you can see, the regions have all grown quickly over the last 3 or 4 years, and that's going to continue into the future. So being local, being present, being out there has really been beneficial and really been key. And I think one of the things I want to portray for you is that this notion of localization is a big competitive advantage for GE versus other big companies or small companies. And this just gives you a sense of some of the array of investments we've made from multimodality facilities that might be making 4 or 5 GE products in India and Saudi Arabia and Nigeria to low-cost centers in China, low-cost engineering centers in Mexico and Poland, to big localization plays in Africa, Brazil, and Australia. You know, we can just play this. You know, a lot of the oil and gas business has localization content rules. We can just do that better than people because of our scale and breadth. And so you got to think about us playing this global game better, faster, with more scale than any of our competition when you look at how we're positioned today. Services has always been key to the company. It's always been a key part of the profitability of the company, and we have a long history, a massively huge backlog. The installed base grows about 3% every year. Margins continue to get better. So we've got a big installed base, a proven track record of investment around that installed base, and we continue to add more value to how our customers see GE and how we're positioned going forward. And I think what you've heard this week at EPG is something that we've thought about for a long time, which is you may go to bed tonight as an industrial company, but if you're not capable in analytics, you are going to be not competitive in the future. And that maybe the first 100 years of GE was about the physics of the product, but the next period of time is going to be about the analytics. And the way you're going to eat it is through better dollars per installed base, better margins, incremental software sales, and tighter relationships with customers. And one of the things that makes this so powerful is it's speaking the language of the customer. You know, things like the industrial internet, they're marketing phrases that can rally people behind. But when you sit in an oil and gas CEO's office or a utility CEO's office and you talk about no unplanned downtime, asset optimization, enterprise optimization, that's what this means. That's what we're building here, right? And that's where we are. And that's what GE can lead. And, you know, again, it's all about, from our customer standpoint, what's a day of downtime at an LNG plant worth? What is 5% increase in a wind turbine worth? And it's all easily monetizable by our customers. We took a very, I would say, intense strategy to build capability, not buy it. So we've added big players from inside the industry. Bill Rue from Cisco, Kate Johnson from Oracle. We've got more than 1,000 people at our Center of Excellence in San Ramon. We've got they build on 10,000 software engineers inside the company already. And we're hiring people that are data scientists and systems architects, and we're hiring them from all the companies that are out there, and our value prop to these people is great. And then we're adding to that commercial folks. We're adding to that salespeople that know how to do outcome selling, system selling. And because we're first, you know, we don't want to do everything ourselves. Because we're first, we have some real enterprise advantages. So we've got good partners, people like Cisco and Amazon Web Services, some strategic alliances with people like Accenture and others that like in Telaris. We've done some small investing in platforms that we think can enhance the system going forward, and so we're building a core capability there, and a few acquisitions. But look, guys, we've got the best talent, we've got the best partners, and we built the best foundation as we've started into this process of enhancing our service business going forward. And the intent of all this is just to develop our own middleware. So we have built a software stack that can enable user interface, can enable data acquisition from industrial units, and can enable analytics that are built on that. And this is where all the GE engineers are writing. It has a chance to become an industry standard. We're working with people like SoftBank and other telecom companies that want to license Predix. We call this Predix, which is the middleware. And this allows us to launch new applications in 6 weeks. So we can now eat this, right? So we're now building, we're at 40 applications so far. We're in a mode where we can add them quickly, and we'll be this year at in excess of a $1.1 billion run rate that'll show up primarily in our service businesses and drive productivity at the same time. So people, software, output, leadership, first mover advantage, that's the way I would think about this initiative in terms of GE. And then here's some of the applications as you travel around the businesses, and we'll find ways for it to show more of this to our investors as time goes on. But, you know, if we can stratify all the engines we have in CSAs, if we can stratify the wear use and data around, you know, hot and harsh environments and different environments, there's hundreds of millions of dollars of productivity that are built in terms of time on wing guarantees and things like that. Wind power up gives 5% more output to a wind asset, which is, if you're a developer, that improves your returns by 20%. So massively important. On the enterprise side, optimization tools like Telaris, which is a whole airline productivity suite, Rail 360, which is a way to work with the railroads on ways to optimize their fleet. In healthcare, we've got enterprise suites as well. So we view this as a big growth engine, big margin engine for the company going forward, and a place that GE is truly, truly in the lead. You've heard me talk about simplification. I think this has taken on an acceleration inside the company. I think we started with the context of how do we get cost out, particularly in the overhead of the company, and now it's blossomed to really have four key parts. The first one is less is more. That companies like ours need to have smaller headquarters, fewer layers, simpler processes, and we've found that as cost comes out, it's also liberated speed and activity. And I think we're just scratching the surface of where we can go. You add to that a real focus on speed. With FastWorks, we've basically taken lean and added to it some principles from Silicon Valley, and it basically puts every process on the clock. I mean, that's the way I look at FastWorks inside the company. It's not good enough to do those two. You've got to have strong commercial intensity. And fundamentally, what we're trying to create inside the company is 300,000 people drive to work every day, knowing that their future is dependent on the markets and the customers, and act accordingly. So tremendous focus on winning in the marketplace, and really implementing information technology that drives margins and speed, and use our scale to achieve administrative scale. And this is a game changer inside the company, and one that's moving very quickly in an important way. So we're well on our way of hitting our 12% goal by 2016. Every business has got SG&A as a percentage of revenue down between 5 and 15%. So this is every business across the company. The enabling functions, this is finance and HR, legal, things like that, are all down 15 to 20% inside the company. Headquarters is down substantially, down $500 million. ERPs are more simplified and reduced, and just fewer processes, leaner processes, more on the clock as you look forward. And I think people see that scarcity drives better teamwork and more accountability, that everything now is mainstream inside the company. And we just think it's, for us, look, guys, 10 years ago, we were 70% inside the United States. Now we're 65% outside the United States in 170 countries across 8 business platforms in a world that's highly regulated, right? Simplification is the way you win in this time period. And so we're driving it very, very hard inside the company. The customer piece is just as important as the cost out piece. So when you think about how you run the markets, we've basically redeployed people from headquarters into the field. We've invested in selling tools and systems so that, our businesses now have configurators and pricing tools and things like that. We have very strong partnership with marketing and commercial finance to drive competitive advantage in the marketplace. And if you look at healthcare, we've got more salespeople despite having less structural cost. We've invested in people that know how to sell the entire solutions of the company in the C-suite. We can now build the products that we make online with configurators. The entire sales force is on Salesforce.com, so we have great transparency around information. I can go there and engage with any sales person in our oil and gas and sales business and through chatter, find out how the account's doing and what's going on real time, and very specific share and margin programs that we can execute throughout the sales force. So huge intensity around the commercial face. At the same time, we're taking structural costs out of the company. And then great leveraging of IT tools. So configurators are driving margins. If you look at the big contribution margin improvements we've made in the subsea business, a lot of those have been driven by information technology. Field services for us, we have a tremendous array of field service people. Using Predix and with our analytics platform, we can now get to the fingertips of people that are doing plant turnarounds in Algeria. All the expertise around how a part is wearing, what the right techniques are, online and immediately. We're bringing sensors and the Predix platform into our manufacturing plants to help us drive more productivity and more speed inside our manufacturing plants. And then overall, just big consolidations in ERPs, the number of applications, shared services in the cloud. So I think the way you got to look at simplification is it's in full flight. And this is going to be big fuel for our margin enhancement as time goes on. So really, guys, technology, I think, highly advantaged versus our peers. Globalization, we've got a footprint that no one can match globally. Analytics, we're eating it right now. It's not a PowerPoint. It is going into the revenue with a big first mover advantage. And I'd say culturally, a focus on competitiveness, speed, growth, really key for the company going forward. And I think we add on top of that great base, on that great foundation, the change to accelerate the industrial financial service mix for the company. So, Alstom's a deal we like. It's a deal that's executable. It's a deal we're confident in. We think it changes the portfolio. It allows us to accelerate the portfolio change. And as we go forward, look, we just want to become industrially a pure play infrastructure company. We're going to look for ways to create value around the non-infrastructure types of business inside the company. And a GE Capital that's highly focused on ways that we can be advantaged versus banks and generate great returns. And when you look at the right-hand side of the page from an infrastructure standpoint, you know, you end up having a really balanced, competitively positioned infrastructure company. Big energy portfolio, big oil and gas portfolio, energy management that's there to facilitate both of those in terms of how you look at where you are and into the future. Aviation and transportation, 25% portfolio, global leaders, well-positioned for growth. And healthcare, this core to the company, leverages the Global Research Center, is an anchor tenant as we go to growth markets. And, you know, kind of the infrastructure model and the competitive advantage we think GE has is really technology, global position, interface with customers, very strong brand, infrastructure brand, and the ability to finance. And on that foundation, we've built very big scale-based, globally positioned companies. So 75-25, a strong portfolio, real platform of excellence and competitive advantage. You know, that's the GE that we're rounding into and growing into as time goes on. So accelerate the portfolio. You know, the awesome deal, Jeff and Steve and the team and I talked about it when we announced it a couple weeks ago. This is kind of the financials we talked about, 13.5 billion enterprise value, 7.9 pro forma EBITDA multiple, less than 5 after synergies, $1.2 billion of cost synergies by year 5, basically $4 billion of net synergies, cumulative synergies over 5 years, and that's net of cost. So tremendous synergy potential in the business, good returns, targeting to close in 2015. As I said, it's a deal that's executable. It's a deal we're experiencing. It's a deal we expect to close from an awesome standpoint. So we have more synergies that we're going to work on than what we told you about. And it's extremely straightforward, right? It's we've got a big installed base. We view services as a competitive advantage. Also match the installed base, and we think we can add value as that takes place. So that's a pretty clear synergy. A gas turbine, we've got high market share, almost 50% gas turbine market share today, but this is a way to add more content to that through balance of plan and project management. We have a good onshore wind business. They have offshore wind and hydro. That's a good framework. We've got a very strong growth market platform. They add to the growth market platform. So a lot of the revenues of Alstom are in emerging markets. The combination takes us almost to $60 billion in growth markets. Alstom has a much stronger steam portfolio than we do and a much stronger grid portfolio than we do. And that, I think, is an addition. And, you know, we've acquired two Alstom companies. We acquired their gas turbine business in 1999, we acquired their power conversion business in 2011. So we have a lot of Alstom people inside the company, and we have great access to what they're doing and how they're doing it. So it gives us confidence as we look at the company and what we can do. So strategic opportunity at a fair price. It's complementary products in common markets. And so that's kind of the way we've looked at this deal as we've gone forward. And, you know, we are extremely experienced in Europe and France. So we built on a history of CFM, maybe the most successful industrial joint venture in the history of the world. We built on the Thomson CGR relationship that's more than 25 years old. We acquired the Alstom plant in Belfort. Our biggest advocates in France are the employees of the Alstom plant that we acquired in 1999. You know, that speak very highly of the company and the changes that they've seen. The power conversion is a recent acquisition and rounding into shape, and we add to that the work we've done with Nova Pignoni, building the oil and gas business, Jenbacher, Avio, so a tremendously strong framework. So as a lot of European companies, Alstom has a lot of employees globally, but, you know, 24,000 outside of France in Europe, and then 9,000 in France, and that's how GE compares. And you guys have read, you know, as we've spoken to the French government, we've talked about this being a base of the power business going forward. We've talked about adding employment in France, so opportunities to for wind in the country, and to move some headquarters and local partnerships in France. So we think this deal is good for France. It's good for GE. It's good for Alstom. and we're having constructive dialogues along those lines, and we can accomplish that and still generate some great synergies for the business going forward. So I would say all of this at the top envisioned the kind of synergies that we have in place, and as I said, we still have other opportunities beyond that as time goes on. So again, we like the deal. We feel good about the deal, how we're positioned and where we are in terms of the structure, and we're gonna continue to work constructively with the French government as we look at where we go in the future. So 14 looks good. I think we're on track to meet the commitments we made to you in terms of industrial earnings growth, organic growth, margin expansion, off to good first quarter. G Capital, $7 billion running, $3 billion out of cash, but set up for the retail finance IPO this year and the split off next year and using that to retire shares. And then, you know, good position overall. And, you know, think about the company technically strong, very strong. Globally strong, very strong. Analytics in the lead. I would say a big lead, not a small lead. Simplification driving real culture change inside the company. And an opportunity to accelerate the portfolio transition is pretty powerful, and the team's good. You know, I like how the new players are positioned inside the company. So I think that strengthens the company in terms of where we are, and I like the way that's all come together. So that's a plus. A really good bench, and I think the ability to hire from the outside. Look, anybody that was here this week. If they're going to become good at the industrial internet, they're going to hire people. They're going to have to hire people from the outside. You know, I mean, the software language is DevSpark, right? Those are the tools. Those are in Silicon Valley. They're not in Fairfield, Connecticut, or Schenectady, New York, or Atlanta, Georgia. You know, you're going to have to be able to do that. And from a compensation standpoint, guys, I can tell you, we are continuing to evolve our thinking on incentive compensation. We're going to look harder at margins and return on invested capital. Jeff Bornstein's leading the team right now. He's going to take a look at the incentive comp and how we structure it going into 2015 and beyond. And so just a different company with a lot of good tailwinds and well-positioned for the future. So let me end there, and happy to take questions. Got the mics out? Yeah, Scott.
Sure, Jeff. I'm sure there's not a lot you can say, so I might be going down a rabbit hole here, but this Alstom is, excuse my French, but becoming a bit of a shit show.
I'm not sure I know the translation of that. But,
I think it translates as shit show. How do you solve for this not becoming a big drama, a bidding war, a huge distraction that ends up with the end up that, you know, losing it anyways? And kind of what's plan B? I mean, at what point do you say enough is enough?
You know, Scott, I would make a couple comments. You know, the first one is, this is a great company. Whether we do this deal, there's not one initiative that would change. There's not one outlook that would change, regardless. The second is you have to trust us a little bit that we know what we're doing. I mean, you guys, you just have to say, this is a company that's done a lot of this in the past. We know how to do diligence. We know how to work with governments. We have an impeccable reputation in France. We're extremely experienced on this, that we know what we will and won't do in a very disciplined way. And I think, you know, have thought all this through. So, you know, I just would say you can describe the show any way you want, right? I don't sit here and say, God, I'm surprised. I just, you know, we've done this before. And that's the best I can tell you, right? And I would say at the end, look, guys, I want to give you the impression that we like this deal and we're confident in this deal. We really are. Now, these things will get played out in the media, but underlying, there's a win here for GE, there's a win here for Alstom, and there's a win here for France. And if we weren't confident we had all three of those things, we wouldn't be here right now. So, you gotta know that. Good.
Fair enough. And then, I'm gonna steal the microphone for one more second here. The one business that, that some of us have some concerns about is just U.S. healthcare, and it's really developed markets healthcare. It's Europe too. And yeah, how do you solve for diagnostic equipment? Kind of, I don't want to call it secular decline, but maybe flatlining from here with headwinds. I mean, are there new business models or new things that you can consider there to? I'll just stop there.
Look, I think the way we do our planning, near term planning, around core DI and developed markets is for flat markets. And then it's going to shake out, right? So I think you have to look at it in the context of growing services, growing information, running the table in emerging markets, having a good focused niche life science business, and that constructing a business that is mid-single digit revenue growth and double-digit operating profit type growth, given simplification, given productivity, given the things that we've done. There's not an acquisition out there that would, you know, we don't look to see anything other than what it is. And then, Scott, I just think the dust clears at some point, right? There's going to be consolidation in the providers. There's going to be a sense of who the winners and losers are and things like that. And then I would ask investors to step back and say, once that all happens, you still have a healthcare that's 20% of the global economy and growing at maybe 2x the GDP, even with all those problems. So I think you'd stay focused in the short term on what you can fix. But over the long term, I still think there's some juice in the model. Yeah. Yeah, Jeff.
Just back to Alstom, but more just what it means for your power business. And the nature of my question is, the way you show it, it feels like it's a nice offensive growth move. But the more I think about it, it kind of feels defensive. And what I mean by that is historically you've been able to really cherry pick the gas turbine and avoid all the kind of danger, volatility, unbalance of plant and EPC work and everything. How important is this to protect your gas turbine franchise? And if this deal doesn't happen, is there some other path to go ahead and kind of fortify that position?
So, you know, Jeff, the way I look at it, first and foremost, think about this as a service deal. You know, in other words, if you look down kind of like, how do you think it through? You've got a big increase in installed base. It's kind of what we were put on earth to do. It adds capability, it adds scope, it adds installed base. And so you start from this massive position of value creation to begin with. And then, look, we finished the year, like, if you look at the fourth quarter, you know, we finished last year close to 50% market share in heavy-duty gas turbines. So, you know, we're able to run this play however you want to run the play. I think this gives us more value content, which I view as totally incremental upside. So it gives us, you know, value content in the bottoming cycle. It gives you more value content around the projects. It allows you to be smarter around the world in terms of how the projects take place. But I view that not as playing defense. I view that, Jeff, as incremental upside in terms of where we go. And then from a grid standpoint, you know, this is, you really do have a chance to make 1 + 1 = 3 in terms of grid and things like that. So I think it's all on offense. I really do. And I think our market share speaks for itself, really, right now. With the H, you know, guys, we're extremely well positioned with the H in terms of the bidding we're doing right now and what we're seeing in the marketplace. And so, you know, we feel good about that as well, Jeff. Yeah, Shannon.
Jeff, right here. Yeah, just one Alstom and then one G Capital. On Alstom, I mean, you made the point of it accelerates, right? It accelerates you to the 75%, so it's the fastest way to get you there. You know, you didn't say it was the best thing. Is this the best thing in the M&A pipeline? So if this doesn't
happen. Look, I think from a capital allocation standpoint, you know, guys, look, I want to come back. Because these things are always hard, right? Because there's an element of uncertainty. All of us, you know, none of us like uncertainty. But I would come back and say, we like the deal. We've done this before. We're confident in the deal, right? This will have more twists and turns, but we wouldn't have started if we didn't think we could finish. Without Alstom, we were still going to hit 70% industrial financial by, you know, 2016. So we had a pathway and a roadway to get there. But from a financial standpoint, Shannon, you know, it's well priced. The synergies are good. It pays for itself quickly. You know, so if you look at the pipeline, it's not the only thing that's there, but it's an attractive thing. It's in bulk, you know, so that, I think that's a good thing as well. And so when we add all that up, we thought it was worth, you know, we think it's good for investors and puts us in a good spot.
And then on G Capital.
Well, we're already going to hit 70, right? So it's not like it, you know, we're already going down
that
path.
You're not going to do any other M&A now, 14, 15.
I think this is, you know, this is the one we're looking at right now.
When you get to $300 billion of ENI G Capital, what's the G Capital dividend look like?
Look, I think the way to think about it is you're always going to have a core dividend that's probably along the lines of 30%, right, of the earnings on an annual basis. And then over time, you know, there's still, this place still has a ton of liquidity, low leverage, and so, you know, there's going to be an opportunity for, you know, for special dividends on top of that. So I think we need to get the retail finance split done and then look at how it looks going forward. And we think some of the numbers we gave you,
Do you think you can still grow it and do specials after this is all done?
Look, let's let it all play through, right? And we'll get a ton out with retail finance. But there still is a incredibly, I would say, robust balance sheet in GE Capital as you look at it going forward. Yeah. Andrew. Since Steve decided to keep you guys another year, you got to figure out how to work the mics better or something, Steve. I don't know.
Just a question on Synchrony timing.
Yeah.
So third quarter, is it we're targeting third quarter, or do we have regulatory permission to do it in third quarter now?
I think we're on the track to do third quarter. So again, there's you know, we're now feeling like that's pretty definitive.
And then you sort of talk about extracting more value out of G Capital. You highlighted assets that, you know, shrinking down to $300 billion. Can you extract the cash out of G Capital before completing the Synchrony IPO? As you continue to sell down, you know,
it's the next big tranche, let's say, en masse. But, you know, we continue to look at, to say, what does it mean to be a SIFI? What does it mean to be safe and secure? And I still think there's cash optionality around G Capital. But we like the retail finance. We think that's a very capital efficient way to do it. And like I said, I think we're really on track for Q3. Yeah, Dean.
Thanks, Jeff. I'd like to get some more color around that $4 billion in divestitures that you're looking at over the near term. And your phrasing today is the candidates would be those that fall into the category of non-infrastructure, and you certainly get more than $4 billion of non-infrastructure candidates you could be looking at. And you also don't typically talk about names, so I'm not expecting names. But maybe you can provide for us a color about the approach, the timing of some of these divestitures to get down to that industrial technology model that you're looking for, and maybe some of the idea of staged exits and partnerships, and what kind of ways might these divestitures take form so we can be prepared for that.
So you're right about the part of not naming names. You know, so I think, you know, I look at it to say, Dean, it's not a bad time to be thinking about this. There's a ton of cash out there. There's a combination of real, both strategics and non-strategics who are looking in some of these spaces. We like sometimes the staged exit approach. I wouldn't be surprised to see that take place again as you look at some of these, because we think there's more value creation as you go along, and we want to participate in some of that as well. And there's really nothing holding us back. I think it's as we think it makes sense strategically and financially, we'll continue to go forward.
Just one clarification: out of these divestitures for this year, you're contemplating, would there be gains that would be used to offset some of the naked restructuring you're looking for now?
Yes, I mean, I think Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong. We announced the Wayne disposition a week or two ago. That has a gain associated with it that'll, you know, we're doing a lot of restructuring in the second quarter, so that has a gain associated with it. Most of these will, yeah. And I think Jeff and Matt will kind of enjoy, and I'll give you guys up heads up on those as we go. Nigel.
So you're taking the cycle, development cycle of the H-class down from, you know, 5 years to 2.5, 3 years. And that's an extraordinary leap of you know, technology. What is the biggest driver? I mean, I know it's fast work, so I know you use simplification, but what is the biggest single driver of that cycle time reduction? And then on top of that, you said 39 bids for the H-class, 39 proposals in train. That's a lot of activity. And, you know, is that geographically diversified, or is it focused in certain areas?
So I would say, Nigel, the one of the things that helped us in the H-class is we were able to leverage a lot of the existing age that we had out there, right? So the team came up with a novel approach to achieving more efficiency and using that framework. And a lot of it's built around iteration and some of the development tools we've got inside the company. So it's really about modeling faster, improving the cycle time to actually get to test, and being able to drive that through. And the testing lab that we built in Greenville has been a huge facilitator. That's probably in and of itself taken a year off the cycle. And then it's the, I would say there's a reasonable amount of bidding activity in the U.S. that's largely IPPs. So you're seeing IPP bids in the U.S. and then Asia is huge, right? Asia, you know, we basically, I would say for the last 3 or 4 years have received no orders in Korea. So Korea is now an open door for us again. And so those would be the two big places. I would say Asia and the U.S. It's primarily going to be base load. Yeah. Yeah, right there. Julian.
Thanks. I guess in oil and gas, the kind of execution on large projects has been a little uneven the last few years. So with, you know, more balance of plant, more EPC at Alstom, I guess what, you know, what will change in how you're managing those large projects? I think about $8 billion of their backlog is
But, you know, Julian, so what I'd say first and foremost, you know, if you look at our oil and gas business, we've been doing kind of EPC or project management for a long time. So we're hoping from a human resource standpoint we get a little bit more capability there that helps. But a lot of the, if you look at subsea, right, one of the things I look at in subsea is kind of the as quoted, as delivered, right? So you look at the contribution margins as quoted, and then what they came out as. A lot of this is around standardization, change orders, cycle time problems. And so, you know, that's where the primary focus has been to get those numbers up. And then I think anything around project management today just makes you smarter. It'll make us smarter across the company, not just in power, oil, and gas. Okay, boss man?
Not yet. So last year we had a lot more buy-side questions coming in. There are only a couple this year from around the room. One of them is simple, I think. What's the revenue base of GE Mining today? Are they still using a 2016 revenue target of $5 billion, even with the Alstom deal happening?
So it's in the, I would say it's in the $2 billion-ish range. And I would say we still see sluggishness in mining. So I think that's probably going to be lower because I don't count on any acquisitions in that number. So organically, it's going to be a lower number probably.
Okay, and then this one is how should we think about restructuring in 15 and 16 with and without Alstom versus the $1 billion number in 2014? So how much more?
So I my hunch is we'll continue to do restructuring in 15. I don't know, Jeff, if you would add to that, but we'll still do restructuring in 15. We still got a long list of projects. Yeah. So I'd say it's probably not to the billion level, probably less than that. And then there'll be a ton of work, you know, Steve, that's going to happen. You know, if you do Alstom around that base.
And this is from another one here that's saying, to what extent are you worried about multiple compression for overall GE after the deal, given Alstom's low multiple historically and other things maybe slowing? Why not a big buyback instead?
Look, if we thought this was a 6% margin business that we couldn't dramatically improve, we're not going to do it, but you know, we're basically in similar businesses in the same market, and we run our business at a 20% margin. And so I think no matter how you cut it, an investment in Alstom beats a buyback. And that's the way we would look at it. And we think there's a ton of margin potential that's in this deal.
And maybe since there aren't more from the audience, one last
this is
from
come
me.
From
this
Steve.
One's me.
You did all three of those, Steve.
No.
This is like I have a. They're coming in from the field. I do this myself, so I'm great. Let's see. We're going to hear from all of our employees now.
Right. Right. So let's assume that that the earlier question was whether it's true or not that you're actually able to get the margin side of Alstom, right? Whatever bad situation it's in today. You can get the cost side. A lot of the pushback that I get on it, I know, is at a top-line organic growth level. To what extent do you have conviction on the top line of what you're buying?
Well, look, in services, clear. But,
You know, guys, look, coal is still 50% of the global power generation field. It's growing. It's projected by everybody to grow 2-3%, you know, into the future. A lot of it's outside the United States. So I think if you think about the power business post Alstom, we still see that as a mid-single digit organic growth business with a ton of juice. You know, I go back to, if you underwrite this deal, start with the installed base, right? There's just a ton of value in the installed base, and then you can build sequentially things on top of that. Great, Steve. Thanks.